Chapter 7. The Doctor's Bag.
What on earth were you thinking, John? I can't believe you'd do that.
Missy is back from the home of a patient who, it turned out, had not made it through her convalescence. She'd spent many hours of her own time nursing the old lady, but when she got there, it was too late. She had gone. Maybe that's added to her anger now. She had expected to find Holmes quietly asleep in bed. Instead, John has nervously explained their nocturnal trip downriver and Holmes's seizure on the top floor of the abandoned mill. She is not happy. She feels betrayed.
You said you were going to look after him. Instead, the moment my back's turned, you take him on a jaunt across London?
Sherlock Holmes has clearly suffered a relapse. He was as white as death when Missy came in, his eyes dull, barely able to breathe. Now he's dozing fitfully in bed upstairs, one moment feverish, the next semi-conscious.
You're a doctor, for heaven's sake,
Missy continues.
I was. He had a massive head injury. He should have been resting. Even a porter would know that. Even the cleaners would.
John stands his ground.
He wanted to go, he explains. I couldn't really do much to stop him. Did you try?
She glowers at him, nostrils flared. He doesn't dare admit the truth, that he actually encouraged Holmes, accused him about being more interested in Missy's mystery than his own, and he's not even sure he's too sorry. Yes, Holmes is ill again, but it wasn't a wasted trip. John is sure something came back to Holmes as they crept round the deserted mill. At one point, he seemed to be talking to someone who wasn't there. And then there was that final gasped word. Moriarty. A person or a place? What does it mean? How does it fit in with Diogenes, the other nugget thrown out by his tortured mind?
I'm sure he'll be okay, he stammers. I checked him over and all his vitals are fine. It was a little too much for him, I accept that, but he just needs to sleep it off. You said it yourself. He was in danger of infection, epilepsy, of a brain bleed. If he dies, it'll be on your head.
She turns away, leaning on the countertop, breathing heavily. John sighs.
I'm sorry. It was a stupid thing to do.
I'll stay with him, make sure he's okay while you get some rest.
No, I'll look after him. I'm too angry with you to sleep, and right now I'm not sure I trust you.
It's like a punch to the stomach.
Missy is upset, but she's not being reasonable.
John waits for her to take back what she's just said, but she doesn't.
I think you should leave,
she says.
Leave?
John lets the word sink in. All right, I'll... His voice trails away and he walks out of the kitchen. The house is gloomy and cold because the range died while they were out. For a moment or two, he stands at the bottom of the stairs, listening for any sounds from the bedroom on the top floor. But Holmes is no longer muttering incoherently to himself or making the bed springs creak as he fights off his bad dreams. That's something. Taking his coat from the hook by the door, John lets himself out of the house and walks quickly away down Baker Street. A cab trundles past, but he doesn't hail it. Aside from the fact that the air and exercise might ease the hammering in his chest, he probably can't afford it. The few coins left in his pocket after Holmes's extravagance and the rainy day money stowed under his mattress at Pimlico is all he has in the world. Enough for 2 weeks' rent and little else. It's a bright day. John passes a balloon seller, surrounded by children who are unaccountably excited by the bright rubber spheres floating over their heads. Some things never change. There are crowds of people heading up and down the pavement, heading in and out of Baker Street Station. A normal London day. Not all of it bad. That's the thing about London. Even when things were at their very worst, during the great cash out, for example, the city knew how to put on a brave face. The pubs were still full. Londoners never forgot how to laugh. The very normality of life around him somehow amplifies his own sense of failure. He can't believe he's been so stupid, just when his life seemed to be about to change. First the operation, then 221 Baker Street, staying with Missy and Sherlock. He was even indulging the absurd dream of becoming a doctor again. He passes an advertising board for the latest edition of the London Enquirer. Richmond plane crash. Were pigeons responsible? Fake news? or just desperation on behalf of a journalist with no information. These days, it's hard to tell the difference. The date is printed at the top of the poster. In all the excitement of the past few days, he'd lost track of time. It's Monday. His rent is due, and there's no chance of an extension. As his landlord, Mr. Oldacre, will point out to anyone who'll listen, quality housing is in short supply in London. If you can't pay, there'll be 100 who can. John has been late twice. It won't happen a third time. Once he's paid up for this week, he'll only have enough for one more. Does that give him time to find work elsewhere? Another hospital might be difficult without a reference, but maybe he could try one of the walk-in clinics down at the docks? When a stevedore gets hurt, all he wants to do is get back to work. He's not too fussy about who patches him up. Tired and angry with himself, he walks in a daze, and by the time he gets to his Pimlico lodging, the afternoon shadows are already lengthening. Down in the basement, Oldacre's dark shape moves haltingly behind the net curtain. He's an old man, in his late 70s, but that doesn't take away from his dominance, his clear enjoyment of the power he wields over his tenants. He'll be doing his rounds at 6. If John keeps his door locked and the lamp sunlit, perhaps he can avoid his landlord for a couple of days until he finds work. He lets himself into the house quietly and tiptoes up the stairs. It's actually not such a bad place. Clean and orderly, with pictures on the walls and decent carpet stretching up all 4 floors. If only Oldacre weren't so greedy. He's filled it with too many tenants, 7 of them in as many rooms, sharing the kitchen and waiting their turn outside the 2 bathrooms. The house has become a collision of different lives. The people who live here try to get on, but it's not so easy when there's no escaping each other. A sort of stoical acceptance is the norm, but tension and arguments that may turn violent are always just around the corner, or on the other side of the next door. John's room is at the top of the house. As he reaches the 2nd floor, he hears a soft sobbing coming from the room directly beneath his. He pauses, half tempted to knock. He knows the occupant. Elizabeth Nicolescu is a new mother, and she's recently been experiencing postnatal depression. John knows that she would appreciate someone to talk to, but right now he's in no mood to volunteer. Her husband should be home soon. Catalin Nicolescu is a huge docker with a scar that twists the right side of his face into a lopsided, rather sinister grin. The first time John met him on the stairs, he had thought he might be in trouble. But Catalin turned out to be a decent sort, with a soft, lazy manner and a warm heart. He is totally in love with his wife and his new baby girl. Sometimes he comes home with arms full of flowers, which he has picked up cheap at the market at the end of the day. Elizabeth displays them proudly and never tells her husband that she would much prefer nappies or powdered milk. John trudges up the last flight of stairs. He's back home. It's as if he never left. An empty glass lying on its side on the table is the first thing he sees when he lets himself into the room. And it reminds him that the last time he was here was the night he and Missy operated on Holmes. He knocked the glass over, staggering up from his 3rd celebratory nightcap. As well as the whiskey, he had been drunk with pride, with the possibility of a new life opening up before him, a life of professional fulfillment, of respect and friendship and perhaps more, with Missy. Fool. The corner of his medical bag peeps out from under the bed, and he kicks it out of sight before throwing himself down on the mattress. His body is heavy as lead. It was hard work, trying to get Holmes back to Baker Street. The cabbie who picked them up at Westminster Pier thought he was ill and wouldn't help John get him inside. John's back hurts, and his arms ache from supporting Holmes's weight as he dragged him up 2 flights of stairs when they got in. His head throbs from the sheer bloody stress of the last 12 hours. He stares out of the window and watches as the sun is swallowed by rain clouds rolling in from the south, and soon the room is even darker. He turns over to face the wall. He's woken by an argument. A man is shouting. It's Oldacre. He's in the room 1 floor below with Elizabeth. She is defending herself, her voice high-pitched and desperate. Between them, they have disturbed the baby. Rosanna is wailing. John presses the pillow to his ears, trying to block out the noise. It doesn't work. He sighs and gets up. He leaves the room and pads softly back down the stairs. Halfway down the stairs, He realizes he's carrying the poker from the fireplace. What's he thinking of? He's not a violent man. On the other hand, he doesn't know what situation he's getting himself into. He keeps hold of it. It's only when he's outside the door that he hears the words and understands what is happening.
I've already given you an extra week. I will not be taken advantage of a minute longer.
Old Acre has often sung that same tune. It's almost as if he gets pleasure from it.
But I have nowhere else to go, Elizabeth pleads.
That's not my problem.
John pushes open the door to reveal a room that's a little more homely than his, with knitted throws on the chairs, brightly coloured curtains, and a line of nappies strung from corner to corner. His view of Elizabeth Nicolescu is blocked by Oldacre's back. The landlord is wearing his usual shiny brown suit and leaning on the walking cane that John suspects is more for intimidation purposes than physical need.
You can go to the Haven, he continues.
They'll take the baby from me.
Kinder than letting it starve or freeze to death on the street.
John steps over the threshold. Oldacre turns and immediately shrinks back at the sight of an advancing man, someone who might stand up to him, and one, moreover, who seems to be armed. Elizabeth is standing by the window, Rosanna clutched in her arms. The baby's face is scarlet, the eyes swollen almost shut by crying. What's the matter? John asks her, gently.
My eyes...
The woman's voice cracks and she covers her face with her hand before beginning again.
Catalin was killed in an accident at the docks.
Skull crushed by a girder,
Oldacre adds, with some relish.
What? When did this happen?
2 weeks ago.
How could he have not known? How could he have been so preoccupied with his own affairs that he had been unaware of a tragedy taking place one floor below?
My dear Elizabeth.
He wants to go over to her.
I'm so sorry.
Oldacre lowers his voice and tries to sound more reasonable.
Yes, yes, it is very sad, he agrees, but I'm not a charity. Mrs. Nicolescu has no income now, and there are people lining up to take her place.
If you give me a little longer,
Elizabeth says, wiping her eyes and attempting to control her shaking voice,
I will try to find some tailoring work.
That sounds reasonable, John says to Oldacre.
No, no, no. The rent was a month overdue even before this. It was always late. I've had enough.
He slices a veiny hand through the air. Elizabeth sinks against the wall, closing her swollen eyes in resignation at her fate. Even the baby has given up crying. Suddenly, John knows what he has to do. He has no choice. Wait a moment, please, he says. He goes back upstairs and returns with the envelope of notes from under his mattress. Oldacre stares at the money, and his tongue creeps between his lips. This will cover 2 weeks' arrears, until Elizabeth can find work. Elizabeth's eyes open.
No, she falters, you can't.
It's all right. I'm happy to help you. It's what I want to do.
Very well.
Oldacre sweeps the notes into his hand.
I'll give her 2 more weeks, not a day longer.
He turns and moves towards the door.
It's still £50 a week,
he reminds her.
I pay 40,
John protests.
You pay 40 because you're single occupancy. For a family, it's 50.
But there's only her and the baby now.
That's a family in my book.
Oldacre grins, revealing a set of brown, uneven teeth, then pushes past John out of the flat. John leans against the wall. He's given away everything he had. But then again, what difference does it make? He would have been penniless in a week's time anyway. It's just happened a little sooner. Elizabeth crosses the room and lays a hand on his shoulder.
You're a good man.
She's tiny, no more than 5 feet tall, and must rise onto her tiptoes to kiss his cheek.
Thank you.
From the both of us.
John feels an aching longing in his chest. A wife, a family, love, a normal life. Why were these things never in his grasp? When you're feeling up to it, he says, go to St. Thomas's Hospital. They always have sewing work, mending sheets. And making body bags, he could have added, but he spares her that. She nods, but her face is pallid. She looks exhausted. You should get some rest, he advises. I'm sorry for your loss, Elizabeth. I used to see Catalin from time to time. I liked him.
He would hate this. You always try to look after me.
She goes over to the brass double bed on the other side of the room, and after laying the baby carefully down on a handmade, slightly faded patchwork quilt, sinks down beside her. John lets himself out, closing the door quietly behind him. Old Acre is waiting for him. His eyes flick down as if searching for the poker, which John has left in Elizabeth's room, and back up to John's face.
You also must pay. I gave you everything I had. Then you're a fool. Or do you hope to move in with the pretty widow?
At the sight of his leering grin, John is tempted to snatch the walking stick from Oldacre's hand and crack it across his head. Instead, he just sighs. Can I have an extension?
Do you think I'm a bank? A charity? You gave her all you had?
Yes.
Then get out. Now.
John has humiliated him in front of the mother and her child. This is his revenge. But he doesn't have the strength to argue or beg. As John watches Oldacre hobble back down the stairs, he feels, if not empathy for the man, then understanding. Nobody survives this city by being kind. He could stay one more night, but he wouldn't put it past Oldacre sending in his bruises, and he might as well get it over with now. It only takes John 10 minutes to fill the wheelie case with his clothes, toiletries, and papers, and he's halfway out the door when he remembers the medical bag under the bed. It's heavy and awkward, and he considers leaving it, but the thing is worth good money that he doesn't feel like gifting to Oldacre. Bumping the case down to the basement, he removes the keys from his penknife and drops them through Oldacre's letterbox. Then he trudges back up to the ground floor and lets himself out of the front door. It's raining. The sort of heavy, relentless downpour that might go on for weeks. John needs to find somewhere else to rent. And for that, he needs cash. He has only one place to go. He sets off in the direction of the river. By the time he reaches St. Thomas's Hospital, which looks as unwelcoming as ever, he's drenched to the skin, but he still ducks gratefully into the shelter of the entrance hall. And it seems that for once, he is in luck. The familiar figure of Dr. George Adalgie appears just as he enters, coming out of the lift. The doctor hasn't seen him yet, and probably won't be too pleased when he does. John disobeyed him, and worse than that, humiliated him in front of the consultant, Costello. On the other hand, the two of them have shared history. They were students together. It was George who got him the job here when he returned from Afghanistan, when no one else would take him on. He never did find out why. There's no one else at the hospital that John would prefer to meet. Sure enough, when he sees John, Adalgie's face falls.
John, what the hell are you doing here? I didn't expect to see you again.
George, I'm sorry.
You could have cost me my job.
Adalgie swallows, looking around nervously on the off chance that the senior consultant, Mr. Costello, might just choose this moment to put in another appearance.
You have to go.
I just came to get my final wages. Whatever may have happened, however stupidly I behaved, I'm still owed my final month. The other man looks at his old friend, and some sort of understanding passes across his eyes. The suitcase and the medicine bag, the soaking clothes, all tell their own story.
I can talk to accounts, he says. Wait here, and if you see anyone coming, for God's sake, stay out of sight.
John watches as Adalgie goes over to the reception desk and picks up a telephone. He dials a number, waits until he's connected, then speaks. John is too far away to hear what is said, but it doesn't look good. Adalgie argues. He has his back to John, but his shoulders are hunched and he gesticulates with one hand. Then he puts the phone down and crosses the entrance hall.
I'm sorry. I tried to make them see reason, but they said you were...
He lowers his voice.
Summarily dismissed. So you're not entitled to anything. I'm really sorry, John.
All right. Okay. Well, thanks for asking. George Adalgie examines his old friend.
Look, he says, embarrassed. I could lend you a few quid if you're in trouble.
No, no. John is wishing he hadn't come. I'm fine, but there is something you could do for me if you don't mind.
Anything.
I have a friend, Elizabeth Nicolescu. Her husband just got killed at the docks, and I said she might find work here, in the laundry or somewhere. Do you think you could look out for her? Hidalgi nods.
Of course. I'm sure we can find something.
Thank you.
Goodbye, John.
Look after yourself. That would make a change, John thinks. He walks out of the main door and stands under the porch watching the bars of rain. What now?
The clouds to the west are angry red, like an infection. The sun is setting. First things first. He must somehow raise the money for a night's lodgings.
He looks down at the leather bag, the rain streaming off it like tears.
What need has he got for the unwieldy thing anymore? It's an albatross round his neck, reminding him of what he once was, of how far he has fallen.
No, he'll be glad to see the back of it. The quacks up at Harley Street might buy it from him for a couple of hundred quid. At least, he thinks as he walks away from the hospital, he has helped Elizabeth. Kept that baby alive, in all probability. There is satisfaction to be had from that.
More than satisfaction. A sense of self-worth that sustains him as he trudges on through the rain, heading north.
The windows of the once imposing townhouses that run from Oxford Street to the south all the way up to Regent's Park to the north are plastered with advertisements. There are cures for cancer and impotence, hair loss and blindness, for demonic possession and hexes, for aging, dementia and death. At the lower end, where the windows are mostly intact and the woodwork has been painted at least once in the past decade, cosmetic surgeons display faded images of has-been celebrities.
Pick a face, any face.
While the shabby upper end is given over to the purveyors of recreational narcotics and the occasional drug den. Keep feeding the meter and your drug of choice will keep flowing into your veins. St. Thomas has stopped sending ambulances to these places long ago. But if the management doesn't keep stocks of Naxalone, drug of choice when you OD, at least it's a conveniently short hop to the Marylebone Crematorium. John wanders slowly up the street until he comes to a reasonably respectable-looking establishment, which seems to specialise, judging by the unpleasant images in the window, in fungal infections and skin complaints. The door is opened by a man who has dabbled rather enthusiastically in the enhancements offered by his neighbours. His lower jaw is enormous, like some caricature of a comic book superhero, and his cheek implants are so pronounced that he has to peer over them to make out his visitor.
Let me guess, he says. Impetigo. No, wait, thrush.
No, John says. I'm not here for that.
Penis extensions are two doors down. Say Reynaldo sent you and get 10% off. For 20% on.
He laughs.
I'm here to sell my medical kit. It's army issue, so all good quality stuff.
John lists the contents of the bag, and despite the vast quantities of Botox that have been injected into his forehead, the man manages, somewhat heroically, to raise an eyebrow.
Let me see, darling.
He steps back just far enough to allow John to cross the threshold. It's a relief to get out of the pummeling rain, but the room isn't exactly welcoming. The peeling wallpaper is reminiscent of a nasty skin condition, one that the clinic has clearly failed to cure, and there's a strong smell of bleach. Crouching down, John opens the bag to expose the neat displays of surgical instruments. He has always kept his kit clean and polished. There are no bloodstains or tarnishing or rust. The row of scalpels glint in the light from the street lamps that are just coming to life outside. As the other man fingers the instruments, faces of the soldiers John has saved and failed to save drift across his mind's eye. And then there is Holmes's face, gazing up at him from the concrete floor of the mill, flour in his hair and eyelashes, his expression a mixture of confusion, fear, and perfect trust.
That's the worst thing. When they trust you and you still fail them.
But he didn't fail Holmes, whatever Missy says. And though his career might be over, at least his final act as a surgeon was to save a life.
Nice, Reynaldo croons. Very nice.
He fixes John with an impossibly blue gaze.
20.
John stares at him. But
But there must be hundreds of pounds worth of stuff in here. The stethoscope alone is worth 20.
Take it or leave it, darling. If you don't take it, the man cackles, I don't fancy your chances of keeping it for long. Seems to me you don't have a choice.
He's right, of course. John should take the money, hunker down with a roof over his head. If he brings this stuff to a haven, it will be whisked away from him as soon as he walks through the door. And yet he can't bring himself to shake the man's outstretched hand. Can't quite extinguish the tiny flame of hope that is still flickering in his heart, like a pilot light when the fuel's running out, that maybe one day he might need it again. He closes the bag and gets to his feet.
Okay,
Reynaldo sighs theatrically.
You are a hard man. 30.
John pulls up his collar and steps out into the rain.
50. 50 pounds.
Raising his hand in farewell, John doesn't even pause when the man calls after him.
65. 70.
He's made his decision, though it may be one that he will come to regret. He must go back to Baker Street. He must hope Missy has forgiven him and will take him back in. I think you should leave. He remembers her last words to him, but she was upset. Maybe she didn't mean what she said. He will throw himself on her mercy if he must, but there's a part of him that fears he will not survive the night if he's forced to stay out in the street. He walks for 20 minutes. He's so busy trying to keep warm, his shoulders hunched around his ears like the bedraggled pigeons huddling on the window ledges, that he only realizes that he has reached Baker Street when he almost collides with a man sheltering under the eaves of a second-hand clothes shop. John apologizes and walks on. The rain has tailed off by the time he approaches 221. But before he comes quite level with the house, he stops on the other side of the road. There's a light on at the back of the house, and from where he is standing, he can make out Missy's figure moving slowly past the window on the ground floor. Does she look a little sad? Or is that just wishful thinking? She's wearing her hospital uniform and talking to someone out of sight. And then, to his shock, Sherlock Holmes rises from the chair in the darkened living room. From this glimpse of him, it would appear that the fever has left him and he has been restored to full health. Another small miracle. John is standing directly under a street lamp, in full view if Holmes were to turn to the window. Instinctively, he steps back into the nearest doorway, but instantly regrets it. He should have just continued on his way. To anyone passing, he'll look like a peeping Tom. And what if Holmes or Missy notices him? They'll think he's spying on them. Missy walks out of the living room and Holmes follows. This is John's chance to approach and ring the doorbell, but just as he's about to cross the road, the front door opens and Missy emerges in her coat. Holmes is standing inside, and John can hear her giving him instructions to lock up after her. He presses his back against the door behind him. There's the clunk of a door closing, and Missy's brisk footsteps recede. At the same time, the man who is sheltering under the eaves steps out and begins to walk, heading in the same direction as her. John wonders if he should go after them both or cross the road and make himself known to Sherlock Holmes. He realizes he's behaving ridiculously, like a frightened schoolboy. He's afraid of being rejected a second time. He wants to go in, but he can't. And then he hears it. A distant cry. In that moment, everything crystallizes. The voice is Missy's, and the man he bumped into, the man who was sheltering outside the clothes shop, he didn't just walk in the same direction as Missy. He was waiting for her. He has followed her. John sets off at a run, his medicine case bumping against his bad leg. For the past few days, he'd been able to ignore the pain of his old wound, but he notices it now. He puts it out of his mind. He can't let it slow him down. As he takes the corner, the cries become louder, and now he can make out what Missy is shouting. You've got my bag, now leave me alone! It's coming from an alley a little way up on the right. The surrounding buildings are shops and offices, and they're all closed for the night. But it wouldn't matter if there was anyone inside. Few have the courage or foolishness to respond to a nocturnal cry for help. Missy starts screaming. Without a second thought, John rushes towards the alley. He curses the fact that he has packed the gun in his case. No time to stop and get it now. He comes level with the mouth of the alleyway, and the headlamps of a passing cab reveal the scene before him. A massive black-clad figure in a balaclava has Missy's bag in his hand. In the other is a long kitchen knife which he is slashing at her while she tries to defend herself using the metal lid of an overturned bin.
Throwing both bags to the ground, John blunders forward, splashing through puddles, and hurls himself at the attacker, grabbing him around the neck and yanking him backwards. It's only through the element of surprise that he manages this at all. The attacker is huge, as solid as a bull. As he stumbles back, he loses his footing, and they both go crashing to the ground, the man's full bulk landing on John, winding him. With a roar of rage, Missy runs at the man, the bin lid lifted into the air, as if she intends to bring it crashing down on him. But the man coils both his legs and kicks her away with such force that she slams against the wall and crumples to the cobblestones. Fury gives John strength, and he slams the man's arm so violently against the ground that the knife clatters away into the darkness. The man throws his head back, catching John in the face and half-blinding him. Dazed, with blood pouring from his nose, John can do nothing other than attempt to shield his face as the man in the balaclava gets to his feet and starts raining kicks on his head and torso. Instinctively, he curls into a ball to protect himself, while his shocked brain composes itself for some kind of useful response. If I can just... He writhes as the boot slams into him. If I can just get up. The man lashes out again, his toe cap punching into John's chest, sending a shockwave through the rest of his body. Then maybe I can... But it's no use. The blows just keep coming, knocking any coherent thought out of his head. Lights explode behind his eyes. Soon he will lose consciousness. And then there's someone else in the alleyway. Another thug? Were there two of them all the time? No. Lying on the ground, John sees a gleam of silver, and the man who was attacking him, killing him, cries out, staring in astonishment at one of John's own scalpels, which is now jutting out of his thigh. For a brief moment, John blacks out. When he opens his eyes again, the man in the black balaclava has gone. John, are you conscious? Someone is shaking him so violently that his teeth rattle. He groans. The flame of a cigarette lighter illuminates the face of Sherlock Holmes.
Oh dear, that's not pretty.
Missy, John croaks. Holmes moves away, and John struggles to a sitting position, clutching his ribs and trying to breathe through the pain. She's alive, Holmes says, returning to his side. Just dazed.
He was trying to kill her.
Grunting with effort and using the bin for support, John manages to haul himself to a wobbly standing position.
Where's he gone?
The way he came. In the flickering flame of the lighter, John can see a trail of blood leading to the end of the alley. There is wasteland on the other side. All the buildings were torn down during the last pandemic. Halfway along, one of his scalpels is lying in a greasy puddle. Holmes goes over to it and picks it up, wiping it clean on his sleeve.
You got him, John pants. Good work.
Not at all, Holmes replies. I missed his femoral artery. That would have really done for him. As it is, he got away.
But you saved our lives.
Do you think you can help me get Missy home?
Home. The word John most wanted to hear.
I'll do my best, he says.
They make very slow progress, John limping and coughing and having to pause every so often to catch his breath. But finally, they reach the door of 221. Holmes helps Missy inside, and John limps after them into the living room, sinking down onto the wingback chair as Holmes makes Missy comfortable on the sofa, wrapping her in the throw folded over the arm. She seems woozy and weak, but other than that looks mercifully uninjured. John got to her in time. She is safe. He closes his eyes and is drifting into welcome oblivion when something unpleasantly cold is wiped across his forehead. The sharp pain and sudden stink of medical alcohol brings him round. Opening his eyes, he finds Holmes beside him, dressing his forehead using the box of gauze from the leather bag now lying open on the floor.
You went back for my medical bag, he breathes.
Of course, the doctor needs his kid.
John tries to say something else, words of gratitude, but his mouth won't seem to obey the signals from his brain. He is dimly aware of a pillow being slid under his head and a soft blanket being pulled up to his chest. He has a sense of great comfort, of belonging. The range is back on, and he feels its warmth, reaching out to him.
Then the world winks out.